Welcome to Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. We have quite a variety for you in this edition, including Lee Carroll and Connie Milligan, the Lexington couple making it their mission to bring an amazing lineup of international musicians to the city.
It's an extension of the joy that we've had in our years of travel and our desire to be more than a tourist when we visit a country, but to really take a deep dive and get to know people and really understand that culture.
And you'll hear some samplings. Just to whet your appetite, here's a smidgen of the piano of Cuban artist Axel Laugert. Foster Ackerman, author of a book about the hidden history of horse racing, stops by, and we'll have a new chapter of our series, Humans of Central Appalachia. We begin this hour with a clip from a video from the Pew Charitable Trust's Chris and Kimmy Linneman describing Chris's encounter with a super bug.
My original injury came during a basketball game.
Well, he had had surgery on his ACL, and Chris actually had already started doing all the recovery process and was walking well. And so we were given permission to go on a trip.
And on our way back home from that vacation, we stopped at a water park.
Within, I would say, less than 10 hours, his leg was completely swollen, red, hot to touch.
I went to the doctor the next day. They were determined that I had acquired a MRSA infection in my knee.
The doctor said that we would need to stay in the hospital and be isolated for a few days. They sent us home. His symptoms kind of resurfaced.
It felt like the rest of my body was just deteriorating.
Go to the emergency room.
Put me into panic
mode. What if this doesn't go away?
They did several more surgeries on Christopher's knee.
Multiple surgeries.
Trying to get the infection under control. There was something going on outside of the surgery that we had not seen.
They didn't know where else to look for the infection.
Possibly gone to his brain. The doctor basically told me at that point that it had gone to his brain, that there wasn't a lot that they could do because he was on the highest, most potent antibiotic that they know to treat MRSA. And I faced the realization that I might lose him. And at 30 years old, I wasn't ready to be a widow or to be a single mom. They went in and removed it all. But with that, Chris lost a lot of movement. And his leg, he was unable to do the easy things like go to the bathroom by himself or get food for himself.
I couldn't be the husband that I needed to be, that I wanted to be for my wife. I couldn't be who I wanted to be for my kids.
When he was really sick, my son would take his Legos and sit on his dad's bed.
I love being a dad more than anything, and not being able to be that wrestling, running around, Lego building, tea party, sipping dad that I had been. It was incredibly difficult emotionally.
2 million Americans get antibiotic-resistant infections every year. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, those drug-resistant infections are responsible for 23,000 deaths each year in this country. Kentucky has the highest rate of antibiotic use in the entire nation. It's especially high in eastern Kentucky, where in some areas, children are receiving 3 times more antibiotic prescriptions than the national average. And now, an awareness campaign is underway statewide to try to reduce those numbers. Here to fill us in is Dr. Bethany Wattles, a clinical pharmacist in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Louisville School of Medicine. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Wattles.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the statewide awareness campaign about antibiotics.
Yeah. We are launching a statewide campaign. It's called Kentucky Antibiotic Awareness. And with the support from other researchers at University of Louisville and then Kentucky Medicaid, we're able to distribute information, educational materials, both for the public and for healthcare providers throughout the state. And what we're really trying to get at is just reducing the number of inappropriate antibiotic prescriptions throughout the state.
In preparing for this conversation with you, I came across a statement by Dr. Forrest Arnold. He's epidemiologist for the U of L Hospital and associate professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases in the U of L School of Medicine. And he said that, quote, multi-drug resistant bacteria and XDR bacteria, those with resistance to all existing antibiotics, are actually evolving faster than the drugs to kill them. That's pretty unnerving. How concerned should we be about that?
Very concerned. That's, you know, what I'm really passionate about and what this work is trying to prevent. The problem is the bacteria kind of outsmart the medications that we have to where the medications aren't working anymore. But unfortunately, we're just not seeing a whole lot of new antibiotics introduced to the market. Now, there are some efforts in Washington and with drug discovery that are hopefully going to help us get new antibiotics on the market. But for now, we really just don't have them. And so we have to preserve the ones that we do have and use them only when absolutely necessary.
But how persistent are these pathogens? As we develop stronger antibiotics, do they figure out how to overcome them? Is this kind of an endless game?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, way back in the day when penicillin was invented, Dr. Alexander Fleming, who invented it, he recognized that this is going to happen, that the bacteria are going to develop resistance to the drugs that we have. And we saw it right away with penicillin, and we're seeing it today, too, with new drugs come to the market. Just a few years later, or sometimes almost immediately after, we will see the development of resistance against those new drugs. And so that's why even when we get a new drug to the market, we have to really preserve it and only use it as the last line when nothing else is available.
I mentioned before that Kentucky has the highest use of antibiotics in the country. How extensive is it really?
The data that you're probably referring to is from the CDC. And so every year they provide information about the antibiotic use per capita. And so what we're seeing is well above the national average for both children and adults throughout the state. And then specifically our research work in my research unit, we're able to look at children with Kentucky Medicaid. And that's where we've identified the difference throughout the state and that there really are much higher rates in the eastern part of the state for Kentucky Medicaid children.
So why has this been happening? Are antibiotics being prescribed inappropriately?
Yes. So some national studies as well have found that 30 to 50% of antibiotic prescriptions are probably inappropriate. And so things, you know, we're just learning more about the resistance problem now. So back in the day, it was very common to go to the doctor and get an antibiotic for a cold. But now we know that colds are almost always caused by viruses and that antibiotics don't work against those viruses. So those would be good examples of the inappropriate use that we're seeing too much of, and we really have room for improvement there.
And so how about us, the public? Do you think, do we have unrealistic or inaccurate expectations about how effective these antibiotics really are?
Yeah, unfortunately, a large driving factor for the inappropriate prescribing of antibiotics is not necessarily that physicians don't know when to prescribe them, but the patient expectation. And that if you're feeling really bad from a cold and you go to the doctor, you want to leave with something that you feel like is going to help you get better. But unfortunately, for common cold, the flu as well, antibiotics just don't work for those. So our best way to treat those is just with symptomatic care, maybe some cold medication and things like that. But we really have to save the antibiotics for the bacterial infections that they're going to work against.
In the clip from the video that we heard at the beginning of this segment, the culprit was MRSA, which is an ugly, contagious staph infection that's tougher to treat because it's resistant to most antibiotics. What can you tell us about this superbug?
Yeah, MRSA is something that I think the public's familiar with. We do see it a lot. It's an organism that lives on our skin, so it frequently causes skin infections like cellulitis. It's also a common one that you might see after surgical site infections. But there really are a lot of different organisms that we have to worry about. Another thing that we see commonly or hear about superbugs is with urinary tract infections caused by E. coli. So really, there's a lot of problem organisms out there. And so in all cases, we need to use antibiotics as carefully as possible.
So what are some other health implications of antibiotic resistance?
Well, antibiotic resistance, we've already kind of talked about. If you get an infection that is harder to treat, you're going to have to use stronger antibiotics or potentially get to the point where antibiotics don't work anymore. But another thing to think about with inappropriate antibiotic use is also the development of side effects. That's something that we can see right away and really individuals can relate to because that's what you're kind of seeing is a problem right away. I specifically work in pediatrics. And so with kids, it's very common that they might get diarrhea, yeast infections, rashes from antibiotic use. And so if the antibiotic was never needed in the first place, then that's just really unnecessary strain on the patient and the family that we could have avoided altogether.
So what are some do's and don'ts to remember if you're given a prescription for antibiotics?
If you are given a prescription, there definitely are times that it's needed, and we do need to treat those infections. But one thing to do is make sure that you follow the instructions for the prescription exactly as written, so taking the full course as long as it's written. And what we definitely don't want people to do is save some for later. So especially with kids, you might have a bottle of liquid medication that you don't finish the whole thing. We don't want to save that for later and start using it without the instruction of a doctor's prescription later on. So
what should you do with it?
There are safe ways to dispose of it. Probably if it's just a liquid antibiotic, you could put it in the trash can. If you don't feel comfortable with that, you could also take it to your pharmacy, or there's medication take back days.
Dr. Bethany Waddles, a clinical pharmacist in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Louisville School of Medicine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we posted several videos about antibiotic overuse on our website. You'll find them at esweku.com on the Facts and Information tab. Coming up in a moment, Lee Carroll and Connie Milligan, the husband and wife team behind Green Room Exchange, a nonprofit they've formed to bring to Lexington stages some of the musicians they have encountered in travels to places like Cuba, Ghana, Portugal. We'll give you a sampling of each. And later in the hour, did you know
the first professional athletes in America were black jockeys?
Foster Ackerman Jr. stops by to tell us what's in his new book, The Hidden History of Horse Racing. And a new chapter in our series, Humans of Central Appalachia. Russell Huff, now of Harlan, on growing up with 12 brothers and sisters on a remote family farm in Leslie County.
There was no road in front of the house. The road was in the river. A little creek called Greasy Creek. It was completely pure, clear, full fish. No mining, no run from the settlement school to hiding. And you could drink out of it, you swim in it, play in it. And we ate fish out of it 3 times a week or 4 all the time. And so it provided quite a bit of food.
Russell's one of the more than 400 people from all around the Central Appalachian region interviewed by Malcolm Wilson, who has very generously shared his collection with us so we can bring these voices and their stories to you. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as transformative opportunity for their business and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
We take it as a mission here on Eastern Standard to let you know about what's happening in the arts here in Central and Eastern Kentucky. And coming soon is a series of concerts that brings the world to our region. And here to fill us in is the husband-wife team of Lee Carroll and Connie Milligan. Lee and Connie have a new nonprofit, Green Room Exchange, that will bring an international lineup of musicians to stages around Lexington beginning in the spring. Hey, Connie and Lee.
Hi. Thank you for having us, Tom.
Damn, you make us sound good.
Well, you have a really interesting lineup in store for us, and I can't wait to get into that lineup and hear a little bit of it. But first, Connie, if you would tell us a little bit about Green Room Exchange, how it came about, why you call it that.
Great. I'm happy to do that, Tom. Green Room Exchange seeks to give people the opportunity to see countries through the eyes of the people that live there using the universal language of music and art. It's an extension of the joy that we've had in our years of travel and our desire to be more than a tourist when we visit a country, but to really take a deep dive and get to know people and really understand that culture that they have. Our desire is to bring that experience back home. And we're doing that through Green Room Exchange. To give you a little history, a green room, as you know, Tom, as a musician, is the lounge area off a stage where performers relax. Mm-hmm. And when we have come back home, we've invited people that we've met in other countries to visit us. And invariably, we host big music parties in the big green room at the back of our house. So that's how the name came about, and that is our intention here, is to share that joy of other cultures here in our home.
So it has double meaning.
And yes.
So I've followed you two on Facebook in your travels. You generously post photographs and stories about where you go. It's an itinerary of really interesting places. And you always, always seem to take in the music in those places. Is that intentional?
Yeah, it is. And for me, I want to go places where I can hear great music. Connie's a music lover also. She's the dancer, and I'm the musician. So we're drawn to that. And we've been lucky enough to visit places like Cuba and Western Africa and Portugal, where music is a big part of the culture.
What would you say stands out in your mind as maybe the most interesting or unusual encounter that you've had in those travels?
I would love to answer that.
Please do.
It is being dressed in African costume in a small village in rural Ghana in the Volta region. We were asked to dance to the magnificent rhythm of a huge drum line in this small town that was packed with about 500 to 600 people in the center square of the town with all the drums going. And we were escorted up to dance with them. And as soon as we started, the entire place erupted in laughter.
I was starting to get chills.
Westerners can't dance like they do.
How about you, Lee? Anything in particular stand out in your mind?
You know, from a musical perspective, Cuba was a real revelation. Whether you like what the state stands for in Cuba or not, the state does support the arts in a very significant way. So if you show any talent as a painter, as a writer, as a musician, you get free education and they run you straight through the system. So our experience was walking around Havana. It didn't matter how, you know, it could be a little hole-in-the-wall bar, but the quality of the musicianship was world-class, no matter who you heard or where you heard the music. So to me, that was a real revelation.
You're a keyboardist. I'm a keyboardist. And I wonder if you share this. Whenever I hear Cuba, I think of piano.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing like Cuban piano.
No. In fact, we went and saw a group, and there were some of the guys from Buena Vista Social Club were singing in this group. And it was traditional rumbas and songs. And the piano player was just fantastic. Couldn't speak a word of English. But our translator went over to him and asked him if I could have a lesson. So a couple days later, I'm riding in a cab across Havana to get to this guy's house. And I get there, and there's no translator with us. You know, we tried to communicate as best we could, but I got my little Cuban piano lesson. It gave me some real insight into how they think and what they do.
What I remember you saying is that his house was so humble and his piano was so old, and there were many keys missing.
Right. He would play. There were probably 6 or 8 keys broken on this piano, but I couldn't tell when he was playing.
Isn't that something?
It was amazing. Yeah.
Well, Connie, I know you have a history in Lexington and in the area, being a community organizer, all kinds of events and things around town. And Lee, you've played around town in many different bands, still do. Do you all get a sense that Lexington is ready for something new and different like this?
We have a very sophisticated music audience in Lexington. And that's evidenced by the folks at Origins who have started a new jazz series and have brought tremendous artists down from Chicago and out of New York. And the shows are most often sold out.
Isn't that amazing?
It really is amazing.
I've been to a few of those myself and been very surprised to see that.
So, yeah, they were part of the inspiration for us to form this nonprofit and to pursue our musical interest the same way they did theirs. We saw, well, if they can do this, you know, it can be done in the city. There's always the concern when clubs close down and the concern that people aren't supporting live music because of all the distractions with the internet and Facebook and cable television and all the things that keep people home instead of going out to see music like they did in the 70s when I first came here. Clubs were always packed back then. So it's a challenge sometimes to get people out. But if you present something of quality, people will respond to it. And that's what I saw with Origins, and that's what I hope we can represent.
Well, let's dig into what you have in the pipeline and even listen to a sampling of each of these artists that you're bringing to town. Who's first?
Well, our first show coming up, the first week of April, Gideon Alawarie, who is a Ghanaian master percussionist, and he teaches at North Texas State. He teaches traditional drumming and dance, African drumming and dance at North Texas State. And every year in April, he brings his dance troupe here. And for the last 6 years, we've put them up and supported them and found gigs for them. So they will be here the first week in April. There are two events. On Thursday, April 4th, Gideon will do workshops. He'll do a dance workshop and a drum workshop. This year it'll be at LexArts, which is 161 North Mill Street. Mm-hmm. You can choose to do either the dance or the drum workshop, and they're really a blast. You know, they'll teach you how to play some African drums. Or you can do both. The next night, Friday, April 5th, Gideon's group is going to perform, and they'll do their traditional African drumming and African dance. And then after that's over, I'll put together a band. I call it Lee Carroll's Afro-Funk All-Stars. So it'll be a group of local musicians plus the drummers from Gideon's group.
Oh, that
should
be great.
And we'll do West African, you know, Afrobeat and Afro-Funk. And so it'll be a dance party from that point on.
And that'll be at TD's?
That's at TD's on April 5th. Tickets for these events are available on Eventbrite. If you use that service, go to Eventbrite and type in Afrikania, A-F-R-I-K-A-N-I-A, and those two events pop right up. So if you want to buy your tickets ahead of time, just go ahead, or they'll be available at the door.
Okay, let's get a sampling of this. Let's listen to
Gideon Alawarie and Afrikania.
That's Gideon Alawarie and Afrikania, and I'm talking with Lee Carroll and Connie Milligan, the founders of Green Room Exchange, a new nonprofit in Lexington, bringing world music to stages around the city. So I know that you all traveled to Cuba, and Cuba is the home of the next artist that we're going to talk about here. Fill me in.
Yes, I would love to talk about that. We had such an extraordinary experience in Cuba. That's really the inspiration for starting Green Room Exchange. So our first event was bringing our interpreter during our 2 weeks in Cuba here to Lexington. And we had him talk about Cuban culture, music, history, and all of that. And we wanted very much to bring artists, but we weren't able to get them visas to come. So we have found the next best thing, which is through some friends of ours, we've been able to bring some of Cuba's best and most beloved musicians to the stage here.
This is Ciamora and Axel Laugert. Ciamora is known as the voice of Cuba. She's done, how many records has she done?
37.
37 albums. Wow. She made, mostly while in Cuba. But she's an incredible singer of traditional Cuban music. Her son, Axel Laugert, is very highly regarded jazz pianist in New York. They both grew up in Havana. They now reside in New York. We brought them down for a series of shows last year and had a tremendous turnout. Two nights at TD's, both nights sold out. We also had played a house concert that was sold out, and they appeared at the Latino Festival last year. So we had the whole weekend booked up. They loved it here so much. In fact, the truth of the matter is everybody that we've invited to Lexington wants to come back.
That's great.
People love it here. Axel and Samora want to come back. Jonathan Raganese, who is the music director and who put all the music together for them for their visit this last time, wanted to come back and actually record all that music at Dwayne Lundy's Shangri-La Studios.
They performed with a string sextet, I remember correctly.
The music that Jonathan arranged for them is a string sextet and a jazz quartet, and it is just lovely music. For the album recording project, he's bringing a whole crew down from New York City.
Oh, boy.
So these are world-class string players and jazz musicians that he's going to bring to Lexington. And on the last night, after they're done recording the album, we're going to do a show at the Black Box Theater downtown, the Pam Miller Art Center Black Box Theater, and that's May 31st. Zamora will be singing, Axel will be on piano, Jonathan will be directing. We'll have a string sextet and a jazz quartet. And to open the show, we're going to use some local string players to play some classical pieces, including a world premiere of a piece that Jonathan is going to write specifically for this event.
We are so excited about it.
It's kind of mind-blowing. Are tickets available yet for that event?
No.
Okay.
Those will be available probably within the next couple of weeks at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center website.
So let's get a sampling of what we're talking about here. What do you have for us?
Yeah, we're very excited to share this. This is a sample of a performance that Zamora and Axel Laugert performed here at the home of Denny Williamson, and it was recorded by Dwayne Lundy. And it's just a beautiful example of the luscious music that this team of mother and son play traditional Cuban music.
And this is what we're talking about when we're talking about Cuban piano. Give it a listen.
Yes.
¿Qué te importa que te ame si tú no me quieres ya? El amor que ya ha pasado no se debe recordar. Fui la ilusión de tu vida, un día lejano ya. Hoy represento el pasado, no me puedo conformar. Hoy represento el pasado, no me puedo conformar. ¿Qué te importa que te ame si tú no me quieres ya? El amor que ya ha pasado no se debe recordar. Fui la ilusión de tu vida, un día lejano ya. Hoy represento el pasado, no me puedo conformar. Hoy represento el pasado, no me puedo conformar. Si las cosas que uno quiere se pudieran alcanzar, tú me quisieras lo mismo que 20 años atrás. Con qué tristeza miramos un amor que se nos va. Es un pedazo del alma que se arranca sin piedad. Es un pedazo del alma que se arranca sin piedad. Eva. Thank you.
las cosas que uno quiere se pudieran alcanzar, tú me quisieras lo mismo que 20 años atrás. Con qué tristeza miramos un amor que se nos va. Es un pedazo del alma que se arranca sin piedad. Es un pedazo del alma que se arranca sin piedad.
Xiomara Laugert and her son Axel from Cuba returning to Lexington the week of May 27th through the 31st as part of the Green Room Exchange. And here to tell us about one more artist that they're bringing in the Green Room Exchange concert series, Connie Milligan and Lee Carroll. So coming up next in September, you have quite a lineup. This is not just one single artist, but a group of them. Tell us about this.
Again, it's a product of some of the amazing experiences we've had meeting people from other countries. Over a year ago, right after we formed Green Room Exchange, I was in Chicago for a conference, and I was calling an Uber to get back to the hotel. And I hit the wrong button and ended up getting one of those big Lincoln Continental Ubers. And when I got in, there was a man with dreadlocks who was playing this amazing African music. And I said, oh, my goodness, what is that fabulous music? Whose music is that? He goes, it's mine.
Oh.
I go, oh, well, I want to tell you about what we're doing, and I want you to meet my husband. So we went back and picked Lee up and ended up driving around for a long time that day and then the next day talking about our mutual interest in promoting music from different cultures. He's from Senegal. So we have been desiring to bring the music of Senegal to our area. Lee, in fact, has a Senegalese drummer in his band Ethos Jazz Quartet. And also with the fabulous success of the movie Black Panther, which highlights that music, we knew that this would be a very interesting time to do that. So we've talked to Alioune Gissé is his name, and his management company, and they are just very eager to come. But that's not all. We have also been talking with a woman that we just met, as a matter of fact, in the last month, Valerie Kamani from Kenya. And she has been an amazing star in her country as the voice of Kenya in the contest. And she has come to the United States and recorded and performed extensively in the United States, the last thing being with Cirque du Soleil in Las Vegas in one of the star roles as the moon goddess in the Michael Jackson story that's been performing Cirque du Soleil for the last 5 years. So she's back here in Lexington. She's married to a man from Midway, and she's playing with Lee's band. And then the third person that we're bringing for what we're calling the Voices of Africa is Gidi
Agbeko.
Agbeko. And Gidi has been coming with Gidi Nalaori's Africania group for the last several years, performing and dancing. And so he's a dear friend that we enjoy being with. And he is a wonderful kind of high-energy hip-hop artist that brings the authentic rhythms and music of Western Ghana.
Take me there.
Yo. So it's those three performers for this show. And we're organizing it around the Roots and Heritage Festival with the idea that, you know, Lexington loves that festival and that this gives us the opportunity to highlight some of these amazing artists that we've met from Africa during that time. And so we're collaborating with the Lyric Theater and the Roots and Heritage Festival for these performances.
This might seem obvious, especially after hearing what you all have been talking about, but I have to ask, why do you do this?
Isn't it obvious?
It's so much joy. No, it's self-serving because, you know, for me, I get to meet these tremendous musicians and perform with some of them. And, you know, I feel selfish in a way. It's almost like I'm just doing this for myself. Obviously, there's a benefit to the community, and we feel really good about that. But
I want to say that the bottom line is that we want to share what we have learned in our travels, which is to increase people's understanding and compassion for different cultures, because the bottom line is we are absolutely more alike than we are different.
Well, Connie, we appreciate you sharing that. And Lee, you can just go ahead and be as selfish as you want to be, because clearly we all benefit from it. Lee Carroll, Connie Milligan, founders of Green Room Exchange, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. It's a lot of fun to be on your show.
Coming up after the break, the hidden history of horse racing. And this month's chapter of Humans of Central Appalachia takes us back in time to life along Greasy Creek in Leslie County.
As 13 kids, we were mostly all born at home. And at the time that I was little, there was no road by our house.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Horse racing in Kentucky has a hidden history, and finally, somebody has pulled it together in a book. Foster Ackerman Jr., Lexington native, seventh-generation Kentuckian, attorney, author of 5 books, including The Recent History of Lexington, and president and chief historian for the Lexington History Museum. His latest, Hidden History of Horse Racing in Kentucky. Thanks for joining us, Foster.
Well, thank you for having me on board.
The title of your book implies that there are things about horse racing that, for one reason or another, have not been brought out into the open. Is that a fair assessment?
As much that as we've forgotten.
So what sorts of specifics do you highlight in your book?
Well, one of the things that here in Lexington is very easy to find, and you don't think about it, is the number of subdivisions that used to be horse farms. Gainesway subdivision, for example, was the Gaines family horse farm. Originally Standard Breds, and then John Gaines took it into Thoroughbreds. Merrick Place, Merrick subdivision, another famous horse farm. So a lot of that is, again, if you didn't know that and didn't grow up in Lexington, you wouldn't know a lot of these places were horse farms. Another one of my favorites is the Woodlawn Trophy. That's the trophy that is given out to the winner of the Preakness. The original trophy was the traveling trophy for Woodlawn Racetrack in Jefferson County, Kentucky. During the Civil War, when the track was a Union camp, they buried the trophy in the infield so that nobody could steal it and melt it down. After the war, they dug it up, they started racing again, and it's a traveling trophy so that whoever wins it gets to keep it for a year and then brings it back. The winners in 1870 were two brothers out of New Jersey, and after the races, the track closed. So there was no place for them to return it to, and ultimately it ended up at Pimlico.
Okay, Foster, let's look at some chapter titles and get you to give us a brief capsule of what they're about. And I want to begin with America's First Professional Athletes Class. What's that about?
Well, the first professional athletes in America were black jockeys. Many of them had been trained on the southern racing circuit. Of course, never raced up north because you don't want to put a slave on a fast horse in a free state. Bad for business if you are running a plantation. After the Civil War, however, after emancipation, they now free to ride for whoever they want to, run up to the northern tracks, go to the northern trainers where the big money is. Some of these guys were making the equivalent of NBA salaries today.
Here's another. How Good Intentions Almost Killed Racing.
In the 1880s, 1890s, the progressive movement just spread across the United States. This led to the prohibition against the sale of alcohol. They were chasing gambling as another sin, and to eliminate gambling, they attacked the racetracks, because if there are no races, there's nothing to bet on. So they were trying to cure the sin of gambling and drinking and all this stuff. But they almost killed horse racing because they were closing down the tracks. And without a place to race, there was no point in trying to breed a good horse. So it ended up by around 1920, there were only two states, Illinois and Kentucky, that had thoroughbred racetracks. And we survived in Kentucky by 6 votes. It came before the legislature. The legislature passed a bill outlawing gambling. The governor vetoed it, and the override almost succeeded, but the override lost by 6 votes, two of which came from Lexington.
Can you imagine what Lexington would be like today had that vote gone the other way?
Well, you look at how this town turned out without distilleries. You know, all of Manchester Street in the distillery district, which is coming back now, and craft distilling, all of that disappeared. And it was that, tobacco growing and racing, were the major economic drivers for Lexington in this time period. And you're right, Lexington could have just dried up and blown away.
Here's another, Civil War racing in Lexington.
During the Civil War, of course, most of the tracks closed. Certainly all throughout the South, the tracks closed for, well, major reason being most of the horses became military vehicles. You rode them, they pulled carts, they pulled cannons, they got slaughtered with everybody else. Lexington racing continued, however, and we're the only track, the old Lexington Kentucky Association track up at the east end of 5th Street, was the only track to conduct racing under the Confederate flag during the Civil War, because Lexington was occupied during that September of 1863 when the fall meet occurred. And the general stayed at the Phoenix Hotel downtown, and of course, being a horseman, he would have gone out to the track to watch the races. John Hunt Morgan and his cavalry were in town. You know they went to the races.
Okay, let's look at one more. Forgotten Farms. What's that about?
Well, the Forgotten Farms are the subdivisions I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They were all over the place, many of them in what is now downtown, or what we would consider downtown, inside New Circle Road. There is a famous gatehouse on South Broadway, just across from where the New Orleans food place is, that has little battlements up on the top that now houses several different offices. But it was the porter's house for the farm that backed up to the Red Mile. And you literally came through the gate in the middle of that building. It's now a set of stairs. It's been elevated.
Was it a lot of fun to research this book?
It was a lot of fun. And part of the fun was in the accidental discoveries.
Any eurekas in there? Anything that stood out that you didn't expect to find?
Well, I had no idea that the Preakness Trophy originated in Louisville. If you think about the city of Louisville, just off the bank is a canal that goes around the falls of the Ohio. And that canal was dug much later. There was a place called Harbortown on the south side of the falls. All the water traffic coming up the river had to stop, unload, go around the falls to the city of Louisville, and then come on upriver. There was a big racetrack there, and a resort, and a hotel, and all kinds of pleasure activities going on. And one of the reasons it was a big racetrack, as with our tracks in Lexington, it was outside the city limits and therefore not under the ordinance prohibiting gambling in downtown Louisville.
Is there any trace of that now?
There really isn't. It's been taken over by the government. The digging and expanding the canal just in the town blew away.
That's fascinating stuff. When will the book be available?
The book will be released March 25th by the History Press. And as I understand it, it's probably sitting in bookstore closets right now waiting for the official release date. It can be pre-ordered on Amazon.
So there is a way to do it online.
You can go online to Amazon and pre-order it. It will be in Joseph Beth and Barnes & Noble.
Foster Ackerman, Jr., author of Hidden History of Horse Racing in Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The latest chapter from our series, Humans of Central Appalachia, visits
Russell Huff
of Harlan, Kentucky.
I'm a tour guide and run an automotive parts store and a race car shop.
Tour guide?
I run a tour at Portal 31 in Lynch. It's a coal mine tour where we actually take the tourists inside of an actual coal mines for a 45-minute nonstop historical tour of an old mines.
But this is the story of Russell Huff's early years growing up in Leslie County on Greasy Creek.
As 13 kids, we were mostly all born at home. And at the time that I was little, there was no road by our house. We lived on about 200, 300 acres of land that we farmed with an old mule. And there was no income except for some kind of veteran's pension that Daddy had. And we raised probably cornfield a mile long, half a mile wide by hand. All of us kids hoeing the corn, plowing it with that old mule. We kept regular farm animals, chickens, goats, pigs, 10 or 11 pigs. They run wild, the hogs did. That's where the wild pigs got started, probably over in that part of the country. But we just rounded them up when we wanted them. We wanted to fatten one up. Chickens run free, too, over probably 30, it probably covered 30 acres of our property. They were all over the place.
This was not a city. It was not a town, not a village, not even a crossroads.
There was no road in front of the house. The road was in the river. There was a little creek called Greasy Creek. It was completely pure, clear, full of fish. No mining, no run from the settlement school to hiding. And you could drink out of it, swim in it, play in it, and we ate fish out of it three times a week or four, all the time. And so it provided quite a bit of food.
Home was a clapboard, pine board, batten, tin roof, a big house. It needed to be to house Russell and his 12 brothers and sisters.
There was about four bedrooms, and we'd stack them up. The little kids would sleep four laying one way, three or four laying the other way. And then I'll get in there. And then as you got bigger and needed a little bit more privacy, two or three of older boys would share a room, individual beds. And the girls, of course, had the older girls had their own rooms.
The nearest store was 5 miles away.
And the only vehicle that ever went up and down through there, except for an occasional log truck, was an old Jeep that carried the mail up and down the riverbank. And if we wanted something, we would put a note in the mailbox with the money, like some pop or box of crackers or something. Yeah. And the mail lady would pick it up at the store and then set it back by the mailbox. And we'd go over and get it. So we didn't leave the property much. It was just too much work to do.
Hard work. Strict parents.
You didn't never backtalk anybody. You get a switching.
No running water, no electricity. Long walks to and from school every day, whatever the weather.
I went to school at a little block, one-room school called Abner's Branch. And we walked around the side of the hill about a mile and a half. And there was no snow days. If it was a weekday, you went to school. School turned out back in April back in them days. And if you needed to stay home and work in the garden or something, that was okay, too, in springtime and even in the fall. So we walked to school, we walked home for lunch, and winter, summer, I remember my knees going up to the snow walking home from school. We'd walk home at 12, be back at 1, and then walk back at 3. We got an actual road up out of the river when I was about 8 years old, and we got a school bus when I was in the 7th grade.
And school buses would soon enough become a big part of Russell's life when they showed up.
We couldn't go to Leslie County High School. Like I said, there wasn't no road. So they arranged if we could somehow get to the Harlan County line, they brought us out of there to Kaywood High School. And sometimes the bus run up Leslie County. Sometimes we walked 4 or 5 miles in the morning. So we were up about 3:30 or 4. We caught the bus at the Harlan County line at 15 to 5. We got home at 15 to 7. We were riding 40 miles one way. We would ride to Greenhill, about 20 miles,
15 miles, switch out to another bus that come up from Pineville and ride on to Cable. And then do the same thing going home and hope that the Lester County bus is waiting on us if it's pouring rain. If not, we walk.
It might sound like a hard life, and some might be tempted to make assumptions.
Used to, we were stereotyped as hillbillies and unintelligent and stuff like that.
But those doing the stereotyping would probably be surprised to learn how Russell and his brothers and sisters, isolated out there on Greasy Creek, Kentucky, spent their evenings.
Well, it was good compared to today's life, I guess, if I want to make a comparison here. I had more time to read. I wrote a lot of poems, wrote a lot of short stories. Seemed like that it was more peaceful back then. Nowadays, you got a cell phone that goes off 100 times a day. I very seldom get time to write poetry anymore. I do a little bit from one of my friends. They'll tick me off, and I'll write them a little funny poem, you know. But back then, I wrote constantly, and a couple times a month, the teacher would load us all up they wanted to go or bring them to us and go to the Pine Mountain Library, and we would get books. And so we spent a lot of winter evenings reading.
Yeah.
I've read every kind of book under the world, probably about 10,000, 15,000.
So, poems?
I could probably write one off for you. You want to hear it?
Well, sure.
All right, it's called The Gigolo.
Okay, we're ready.
If you come to my first date, we'll call her Patty. Who's that man? I think it's her daddy, but she got the money from the looks of that caddy. I'm just a poor man, can't pick and choose. Sell my soul for a living, got nothing to lose. But the bill's piling up and rent's due. She pays for everything, even the food. I know it's not right, I know it's a sin. I'm living my life as a step-boyfriend.
So, maybe Huff Daddy?
Ain't nobody talking to me. I sent that to my nephew's recording studio down in Nashville. He sent it back. We don't want that stuff here. Nashville's in bad enough shape.
Russell Huff of Harlan, Kentucky, another Eastern Kentuckian with a story to tell, part of our series Humans of Central Appalachia. Interview audio provided by Malcolm Wilson. You can learn more about Malcolm's project by going online to humansofcentralappalachia.org. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of ONE, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Information about Eastern Standard content partnerships can be found online at eswku.com, and you can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, available for Apple and Android devices. Eastern Standard also is available as a podcast, and you'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.